This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the Vietnam War. And our guest is the author of a newly published history of the war. His name is A.J. Langeth. He's professor of journalism in the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Southern California. He covered the war for The New York Times. His association with Vietnam dates back to 1964, when he first became the Times correspondent in Southeast Asia, and then after that he served for a period of time as the Saigon bureau chief. He also went back on special assignment for the paper Sunday magazine on two occasions, in 1968 to cover the aftermath of the Tet Offensive, and in 1970 to report on the American invasion of Cambodia. And during his time there in Vietnam, he came to know a number of the principals on the U.S. and the South Vietnamese side. More recently, he's been able to go back to Vietnam and also to go to China and to talk to some people who were in leadership positions in the North, people that previously he would not have been able to talk with. He's also been able to take advantage of some material that would not have been available to earlier historians and writers. And all of this has gone into the book, which is titled Our Vietnam, The War, 1954 to 1975. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. We'll be talking this morning about the book and about the war, and you are certainly welcome. That is, you folks who are listening are certainly welcome to call in with whatever questions, comments you have. We ask only that callers just try to be brief in their comments, and we ask that so we can accommodate as many different folks as possible, keep things moving along. But anyone is welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good for anyone, anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the numbers and letters on the phone. 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, Jack Langeth, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on your program.
We have now a number of books about Vietnam. Books have been written by historians, political scientists, and also by journalists.
Right.
And I'm wondering how you think perhaps your approach to the subject as a journalist is different, perhaps, from the way that, say, an academic historian might approach the same material.
Well, I've been pleased that the scholars who have written on the war and have reviewed the book mention its strong narrative, because that's what I tried for. I wanted it to be a story. I teach a lot of students who were not born when the war ended, and I wanted a book that they could pick up in one volume and learn about the people, the events, the decisions, and try to make it as vivid for them as I could. And I'm finding, of course, that the people who lived through it are also interested in hearing how someone sees it. It's a kind of story.
Mm-hmm. I do think that one thing that does set the book apart from other writing is the fact that you did have an opportunity to talk with people who were military political commanders in the North, who in previous histories to previous writers just weren't available.
No, that's right. To go back to Hanoi was an amazing experience, because after all, these were the people who were our enemies. And when I went down to the South, I'm about the only one who called it Ho Chi Minh City. The people there still refer to it as Saigon. But to talk to the colonels and majors who were out in the field fighting our boys, and finding them so receptive and so agreeable, was really quite amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. This is something that I've heard other writers talk about, when one hears of veterans, people who were soldiers who have gone back, and a number of them have gone back,
right,
on humanitarian missions and so forth. It seems that again and again, that's what people comment about. They may, on some level, fear or believe that they'll encounter some sort of hostility, and it seems to be rather remarkable that they don't.
Well, I was cynical about it when the war was going on. We'd hear this report that Ho Chi Minh was telling his people that the Americans were a great nation and that they shouldn't hate Americans. The government was wrong, and someday the government would understand it was wrong. Don't hate the Americans. And I thought that was propaganda for our peace movement at home in the United States. But it turns out that that's what he was saying and that's what was believed. And, of course, it's also complicated or improved by the fact that 50%, hard to tell for sure, 50% of the population has been born since the war ended. So for them, America is, if it's a villain at all, it's a very distant villain.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly both sides sustained very significant losses, much more significant on the side of the Vietnamese.
Yes.
Are there still, as you travel in Vietnam today, do you still see signs and scars and evidence that this war took place?
Well, one of the first things they did, and I went five times to Hanoi, the first trip, they insisted in the nicest possible way that I go off to a few sites, and one of them was an orphanage devastated by the Christmas bombings, Nixon and Kissinger, in 1972. And there were pictures of the children who had been killed by the bombing and some of their mothers. And when I came out, it was that anomaly. People were still, they knew who I was, they knew I was an American. They were still smiling and greeting. They want you to remember this, but they don't want you to dwell on it. Now, because it's an agrarian society, a lot of the bombs, you know, fell in the forests and in the plains, farmland. So you still see some wreckage, and there are still landmines throughout the country that are a constant menace, much as in Cambodia. But a lot of the rebuilding has taken place, and I don't think you would realize just how hideously the country was bombed in the 60s, early 70s.
Hmm. We should, I think, perhaps talk just a minute or two to take a step back from 1954 and talk a little bit about how it is things got to be the way they were then in 1954.
Yes.
Vietnam was a colony of France. There was an independence movement there. The Viet Minh were led by Ho Chi Minh. Almost immediately after the war, they declared independence from France. The French wouldn't have any of it, and so the French and their supporters began to fight the Viet Minh and their supporters. Eventually the French suffered this very serious defeat at Dien Bien Phu, and there was a peace conference in 1954, and at that point the country was divided between the North and the South with this so-called DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone, in between. And so it's sort of that's how we get to 1954, and eventually we get to the U.S. involvement.
That's right. I try to sketch this in briskly so that the reader understands that it didn't start in 1954, that it really started with the French colonization. And you make a point that the North Vietnamese tried to make to Robert McNamara when he was back, the Secretary of Defense under both Kennedy and Johnson, was back in Hanoi 3 years ago in 1997 for a conference that he called on missed opportunities. And he wanted to begin the missed opportunities on both sides with 1961. And they said, no, you see, Mr. Secretary, the big missed opportunity was 1945 when we thought, with the help you had given us to fight the Japanese, we thought that you understood that we were not going to be a colony again, that we would resist this. You have an anti-colonial history yourself, and we were surprised and shocked that you acquiesced in the French returning to their colonies. Of course, the reason was that the people who Harry Truman inherited as advisors and chose as advisors were the Eastern establishment, people who thought much more about Europe and the dangers that communism posed right after World War II to Europe than the colonies in Asia. And if it required for France to be strong again and resist communism, if it required them to reconquer their colonies, that was a price that we thought could be paid.
Yeah. That gets at the very question that was in my mind, and that is, in the United States, was there ever any serious consideration of supporting the independence movement in Vietnam?
Well, when the Vietnamese from the North get together, they lament maybe more than any single fact the death of Franklin Roosevelt, because he had a visceral feeling for the fact that these colonies, and he included the British in India, that these should not revert to their pre-World War II status. Had he lived, he would have had to fight his own State Department establishment, which was quite a bit more conservative on this issue, but he would have prevailed. As it is, however, as we know, he died before the war could be ended, and he hadn't laid down in concrete the tracks he wanted for some sort of protectorate for for Indochina. It would have made all the difference, of course.
Mm-hmm. When this division was made between the North and the South, the Prime Minister of the South became this man, Mr. Diem.
Yes,
Mr. Diem, that the United States then supported.
That's right.
And here again is one of those places where one asks why it is exactly we made some of the decisions we did. Maybe not so surprising that we would support the South, but why it is that we supported him and continue to support him in the face of his rising unpopularity and his refusal to go along with the elections that were supposed to take place in the entire country in 1956.
Well, that's right. That's the other thing that the North Vietnamese tried to impress on McNamara, was that the other big mistake made before he even probably knew where Vietnam was the 1956 reneging of the agreement reached in Geneva 2 years before, that the country would be unified by a nationwide election. We had agreed to appoint Ngo Dinh Diem, a Mandarin Catholic, to head the government. And we were pleased with the way he was maneuvering to consolidate his position. When he decided 2 years later in 56 that he would not join in sponsoring these elections, that he would make himself president of the country and go on as an independent unit, which it was never intended to be, Washington went along because we had the mistaken idea that somehow the Chinese would use a united Vietnam as a stalking ground for exporting communism throughout that whole region. Now, the fact is that the Vietnamese and the Chinese, although both were ruled at the time by communist leaders, had 2,000 years of enmity, that the Vietnamese were terrified about the Chinese coming back into there and ruling them as they had for 1,000 years. We just misunderstood the dynamics of that region.
Perhaps at this point I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with A.J. Langeth. He covered the war in Vietnam for the New York Times. He served as the Times Saigon bureau chief in 1965. He went back again for the paper two times on assignment in 68 and 70. He's now professor of journalism in the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Southern California, and he's authored a recently published history of the Vietnam War. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and the title of the book is Our Vietnam, the War in 1954 to 1975. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. As we talked, the United States initially supported Diem, although became increasingly unhappy with him, in part because his people became increasingly unhappy with him. Eventually, he was assassinated during a coup, a military coup, in 1963. How much did the United States know about that?
Well, we knew everything about it. We abetted, and in fact, it would not have happened without the United States' encouragement. But the problem was that Diem was cracking down starting from 56 forward. He was cracking down not only on dissidents, rebels, and the rest, but even people who had fought against the French during that earlier period, the Viet Minh. And as a result, in the North, they were getting these alarming signals. The leader, a shadowy figure who really emerges, I think, in my book more clearly than I've seen in past writing, is a man named Le Duan, L-E-N-N-D-U-A-N. And he went to the Politburo in the North and said, look, if you don't take charge of this rebellion that's growing against Diem, it's going to go on anyway, and we're going to lose any leadership role. And it was that time, in 59-60, that the North started to support the rebels. But a lot of the rebels were made by Diem's own army. They'd go into these villages, they would rape, pillage, do the things that soldiers do when they're out of control. And the countryside was aghast. Now, it was complicated by the fact that Diem was, in fact, a Roman Catholic in a country that was 80% or so Buddhist. And this festered and grew until by 1963, we couldn't ignore it any longer. That's the period when Buddhist monks were setting themselves on fire. Horrifying pictures mm-hmm. that really made the United States recognize for the first time that something was going on in this country that we were supporting, and we had better take a closer look at it. It was then that Kennedy reluctantly, after a lot of debate over a period of months, agreed that the CIA could go forward with its encouragement for the coup d'etat that ultimately led to the murder of both Diem and his brother knew.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. You point to that, to those images that people perhaps will recall. Certainly, Vietnam is a case where people believe the media and coverage of the war had a great deal to do with turning American popular opinion against it, and perhaps they think about images of combat. But this is a case, I think, when even earlier on, here we see just how powerful media can be in getting people to focus on a particular story.
Yes, it's true. I think that commentators have mentioned, and I certainly agree, that there was a turning point when all of a sudden those of us who wrote for the press became less important in informing the public than the broadcasters did, the television people. Morley Safer was there as a young reporter when I was, and his pictures of the Marines setting fire to what was supposedly an enemy village with their Zippo lighters to the grass huts, that upset people in a way that no account, I think, could have done it. It was irrefutable. Lyndon Johnson was furious, felt that it was taken out of context, but thought that Safer had perhaps even bribed the Marines to do it. It was a standard operating procedure, and we had written about it. But all of a sudden, the American public, a two-day delay, because the film had to be shipped to San Francisco and then New York, all of a sudden the American public was seeing it at home, and this was an amazing change.
Hmm. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? They are in Urbana, and it's line number one. Hello?
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. In your brief recap of the 1954 Geneva Accord,
right?
Maybe inadvertently you failed to mention that part of the agreement was that the Vietnamese would be allowed to vote for reunification in the late, you know, 6 years or 8 years after the accord, which agreement was, or which promise was broken. I wonder if someone could comment on that.
Well, yes, it actually was 2 years, and the agreement was structured in such a way that the North agreed to send back to the North some of its cadre who had been fighting the French. The United States helped a number of, perhaps as many as 800,000, people from the North who didn't want to live under Ho Chi Minh. These were largely Catholics, to go south. So this transfer was arranged. Now, the people from the South who were being shipped north couldn't understand why they had to, since they had felt they had won against the French, why they had to be the one who were dispossessed. There were quotas in the various provinces. And they would stand on the pier as they were going to ship out to go north and hold up two fingers, indicating that just 2 years and they'd be back united with their families. But, of course, that didn't happen. So it wasn't even as long as I think the caller is saying. It was supposed to happen in 56.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's. I think that's an extremely important point, because that's kind of my understanding is one of the, you know, kind of underlying issues which led to the conflict and to the U.S. invasion of the South was this issue about reunification and the fact that that promise had been broken time and again.
Yep.
And that the North Vietnamese had sought for a long time, well into the early 60s, to have a political settlement to the conflict.
That's right.
Now, what? So I think that's an important point to amplify. Otherwise, it all seems rather mysterious and unequivocal as to, you know, what is the nature of the conflict. And I think losing that kind of perspective reminds me a little bit of the current loss of perspective in, for instance, in Colombia, and also in the Middle East.
Well, I think that you're right. And what was astounding to me in researching the book was finding that people like McGeorge Bundy, who's a very smart man, but absolutely ignorant of this part of the world, he astounded Walter Lippmann, the political columnist, well into the middle 60s, when he didn't know when South Vietnam had come into being. He didn't understand that it had been a two-year provisional government just designed to save face all around. And Lippmann couldn't believe that someone who's making these life-and-death decisions didn't appreciate the point you've just made.
Yeah, I think it's rather curious that sort of ignorance, I think it's still around today. I mean, I think, for instance, probably a number of people think that the Vietnam conflict was occurred because the North invaded the South, when in fact the Vietnam conflict, at least in its highest escalation point, was a result of the U.S. invading the South,
Whenever the presidents, Kennedy first and then Johnson and Nixon, spoke about it, they talked about an invasion. And they wouldn't countenance the idea that it was, in fact, a civil war.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting how the official point of view gets propagated into into the media, and even to this day, you know, we hear a lot of myth and nonsense even to this day about the Vietnam War. So I appreciate your attempt to hopefully set the record straight a little bit, anyways.
Fine,
thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, one of the things certainly is true, and you point out that the course of the war and the American involvement in it was determined to a great extent by American presidential politics and by these three individuals who were president. I'm interested in your observations about John Kennedy and what this is, again, I suppose, one of those great what if questions, what would have happened if he had lived, and what the course of the war would have been at the in 19, just to give people some numbers to think about, apparently in 1960, there were only 900 military U.S. military advisors. By the end of 1962, it was only 11,000. Then, though, 7 years later in 1969, this is when Nixon was president and announced the first troop withdrawals, there were more than 540,000 U.S. military personnel there. So there was an astounding sort of increase over those years. What do you think, and I know from having looked at the book, that Kennedy, when he got into office and started looking at what was happening in Vietnam, was surprised and realized that this was not a good situation. What do you think might have happened had he lived?
The thing with Kennedy is that he was elected with apparently about one-third of what we're going to find out of the popular vote that perhaps Gore is getting over Bush, a very narrow nationwide margin. And he was conscious of this, as a politician would be, that there were certain decisions he felt he could make and couldn't make. He appointed a lot of Republicans to his inner circle. McGeorge Bundy was Republican, McNamara, Douglas Dillon, the Secretary of Treasury. He kept on Alan Dulles, the Republican head of the CIA. And his own instincts were pretty good, I would think. I've been reading now, as you can imagine, an awful lot at the libraries and a lot of the classified documents. He had been there as a young congressman to Indochina, and with his brother Robert, he was kind of polishing his foreign policy credentials because he was going to be running for the Senate. And it became apparent to him that the French were losing and that it was going to be very difficult for white faces to continue any sort of successful military campaign in an Asian country. But when he came into the White House, he was confronted with the fact that we were there in numbers. And I think what he was really trying to do, and it's quite clear, because he'd confide this to his political cronies, not to Dean Rusk or to McNamara, the functionaries from the cabinet, but to his political cronies, he said, you know, I'm going to get out of there. We're not going to send large numbers of troops, and I'm going to be a hated man in 1965 after I've been reelected, but I can't do it until then. The backlash would be so strong. You remember, the Democrats are thinking of how the Republicans used the battle cry, who lost China, in 1948 and again in 1952. And so he, luckily for me, I don't deal with the what-ifs. I just tell this is what happened and let the reader draw her or his own conclusion. But if we want to speculate, it seems to me that Kennedy, if he'd gotten any kind of margin of victory in 64, would have used that mandate to ease out. There were always excuses. You could always find some reason for saying, well, we did our best, but the country is so fragmented and so hopeless that now we're going to pull out.
Yeah. I realize, in a sense, we keep just sort of discussing the same issue, but I continue to have the question in my mind, and we've talked about the fact that people who were in the circles of policymakers perhaps had a very poor understanding of Asia. But it still seems surprising to me, given the American experience in Korea, and the unwillingness on the part of some people to get involved militarily in Asia again, why it is we did what we did.
Well, the experience in Korea according to the people who watched Dean Rusk with disapproval in his own State Department, he had not predicted that the Chinese, when he was a lower-level functionary in the State Department during the Korean War, had not predicted that the Chinese would come into that conflict. And he had been, in his own view, badly burned by it. He was a man of very limited self-confidence. And early on, he was willing to turn all the decisions over to McNamara, who was a boardroom bully. There's just no kinder way to put it. McNamara knew how to go into a meeting and dominate it with his experience in the automobile industry. But he knew nothing about Asia. And I've talked to him about this. And he said, well, you know, I admit I didn't know anything about that part of the world, but Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State, and Robert Lovett, all the people who were Democratic and Republican policy mavens from the establishment, they all said it was essential to hold on to South Vietnam, so I just went in and tried to do what they said needed doing. Mm. So there was no independent judgment except the president's himself. And by the time you get to Lyndon Johnson, he's inherited these advisors. Kennedy had, I think, a very good grasp of who could do what, and he didn't have much regard for Dean Rusk, and he, I think, knew McNamara's limitations. Johnson comes in, he inherits these people, and all of a sudden he's taking them very, very seriously. He knows nothing about this part of the world. His only interest is his ambitious domestic program, and he's terrified that if he opens up the Vietnam War, it will derail the things he wants to do in the Great Society and the anti-poverty programs and the civil rights legislation. And so he tries to sneak the war past the American people.
And what's the great irony there is, of course, it turned out that the war did derail
exactly
all of those other things.
That's right.
Because it turned out to, and this is something that I think people perhaps don't appreciate to the extent that they should, for all of those people who attack the anti-poverty efforts of the Johnson administration and say, well, it was a failure because, you know, the government can't solve problems and it wasn't the right approach and so on and so forth, that in fact what happened was that the increasing demands of this war and the cost of the war meant that the anti-poverty programs were never fully funded, so
that's right,
perhaps we'll never know whether they would have worked or not because they really weren't given a chance.
And, of course, that was the crowning bitter irony for Johnson, was that against his will, he had to start cutting back on the very programs he believed in to find the money for this war that he hated.
We're a little bit past the midpoint. Again, I just want to introduce our guest. We're speaking with Jack Langeth. He is professor of journalism at the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Southern California. He is also the author of a recent book that's titled Our Vietnam. It's a history of the Vietnam War from 1954 to 1975. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Jack Langeth covered the war in Vietnam for the New York Times. He served as the Times Saigon bureau chief in 1965. He went back two times on special assignment for the paper in 68 and 70, and then more recently has been able to go and spend some time there in Vietnam talking with people that he would not before, when he was there as a reporter, would never have been able to talk to, people who were political, military leaders in the North. And all of that is in the book, and your questions are certainly welcome. We have another couple of people lining up here. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign. That would be line number one. Hello.
Thank you. Good morning. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were just talking about the cost of the war, and in other than in human terms, in the most recent statement, of course, I mean, you know, the millions of Southeast Asians that were killed, as well as the, you know, three times as many U.S. servicemen have died from the after effects of the war since they came back that actually died over there as well. But in terms of the financial cost, it's my reckoning that we ran up a debt from that not only stopped the Great Society, but we still hadn't paid that off by the time Reagan came into office and ran up the debt even more. So we're, in a sense, we're still paying off the financial cost of that war.
Well, I might say there's one other cost that we should consider. To get the Paris Agreement in 1972, Kissinger agreed to reparations for Vietnam. That Lê Duc Tho, their communist negotiator, asked for $8 billion to repair the country because of our bombing. Some of it would go north, some of it would go to the south. Finally, the figure that was arrived on was $3.25 billion. And Nixon agreed to this because he said it would show the world that communism failed and was turning to us for money. An odd reading, it seems to me. But nonetheless, he sent a letter immediately after the peace accord was signed in Paris, promising $3.25 billion for the country and another billion, up to a billion and a half, in food and commodities. We used, to renege from that, we used the excuse that the war continued. And of course it continued. It continued in the South with our government that we were supporting. It continued in the North. We knew it was going to. So that was just hypocrisy. The fact remains that on the books is this $3.25 billion debt, and I don't expect to see it paid in my lifetime because I think that the emotions run too high. But when I think of how long it took for the Japanese Americans to get some sort of acknowledgement of what they went through, I do believe that one day the President of the United States, whoever she or he may be, will make good on that debt.
Well, and $3.2 billion, even in those days, compared to the damage we've done, is a mere pittance.
That's right. Mm.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to next caller in Chicago, and it's line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You touched on this momentarily just a few minutes ago, but I think possibly the major reason for our being in Vietnam and what really screwed up our foreign policy was the lying campaign of the Republican Party and their cohorts, the press, the China lobby, and so on, blaming the Democrats for losing China. And this spread to their campaign in Europe, where they claimed that it was the Democrats, Roosevelt, who lost Poland to the communists. Of course, the public being the public and pretty damn stupid about the whole thing, as is usually the case, believed it. And this is what essentially destroyed the Democratic Party for a good many years as far as national campaigns were concerned, the presidency and so on. This is what Kennedy was afraid of, what Johnson was afraid of, what Carter was afraid of, and so on. And they're still afraid of it, the leaders in the Democratic Party for the most part.
Well, the only thing I would disagree with what you're saying is I don't think the public is stupid. I think when they're informed, when we're informed, we do pretty well. But when
is that?
We're not. It's a problem. The fact is that in the case you're talking about, the Republicans made hay out of who lost China. It was a major issue, after all. This had been our ally during the war. This was a huge country. And all of a sudden, with not much preparation, we find the public is informed that it is now a communist country and sees us as an enemy. Eisenhower told his cabinet that one of the things they had to avoid when he came in 52, partially because of that Who Lost China rallying cry, they had to be careful that no one be able to say who lost Vietnam. So yes, you're right. It's been at the consciousness of leaders on both sides for many years.
And it still is. Not only that, but during the campaign about Who Lost China, the Republicans went after the experts in the State Department on Asia, and we lost most of our expertise on Asia, and this is one of the things that that weakened us in conducting policy in that part of the world.
This is Robert McNamara's point, and it's a very attractive one for him, because then he can say, well, you know, we, because of the McCarthyite smears and innuendo, we lost all these people who might have saved us. But the fact is there were plenty of people left in the government, and he heard in person from some of them, and he didn't want to hear it. So it's just too convenient. Yes, there were some careers ruined, and there's no doubt that damage was done. One of the things that happened, apparently, was one more reason that made Rusk so timid. He had seen men as self-confident as George Marshall and Hatchison torn apart in the public by McCarthy and his allies, and it made him even more anxious to hunker down and not take on what I consider to be the responsibility of a Secretary of State.
Hmm. I appreciate the comments of the callers. We're growing short on our time. We have a couple of other people. I hope you'll forgive me if I go on, and we'll go next. We've got somebody on a car phone, so we'll go there. Tuscola, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to ask a question since you're a journalist, and you talk about how, and I believe this your view quite accurately, if the people are informed. I'm just wondering why was not journalism up at a little higher level to reveal some of these big weaknesses that we have concerning why we got into the war? And, you know, I mean, you mentioned comments and quotes at Eisenhower that we should never get into Indonesia. And you mentioned many of these other things about the inexperience of some of our leaders. But how come the New York Times or other people didn't bring out some of these things? And or do you think there were restrictions on this? Or were you inhibited from doing that? And if you weren't inhibited, why didn't you have get this information?
Thanks. Well, I think that's really a good point. No, there were no inhibitions by the newspaper or by any of the news organizations that I'm aware of. The thing is this, a lot of what is in my book comes from the fact that I can go now to the, or all of us can, to the Boston Library, the JFK Library, and down in Austin, the LBJ Library, and they roll out on dollies boxes of classified documents. And I would sit there reading these things, the debates, the deliberations, and the rest, thinking how these would have been front-page stories all through that period, from 61 to the end of the war, if we had had them available. Now, the closest that happened, you remember the Pentagon Papers, where McNamara ordered a review of the war for internal purposes, and a man named Dan Ellsberg leaked it to the New York Times, and the New York Times ran it, but that was already 1971. Yes, if that material had come out, I think the public would have had a spirited debate. Now, maybe we still would have gone into Vietnam. There was, after all, there was a movement for protecting the South from communism. But I think if they had understood just how tenuous that original commitment was and how dubious the chance of victory was, that we would not have been spared the whole affair. But that material was classified.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is Bourbon A, and it's line two.
I'm grateful for the author's admission of the Kennedy-approved murder of the President Diem and his brother. If I'm correct, the South Vietnam president had another brother. This brother was the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Seoul.
That's right.
Briefly, what became of this prelate? I'll disconnect and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Yes, the senior brother, there were several brothers. One was murdered by the Viet Minh. Or died in their prison at any event. He was the oldest brother. The next was the brother who became archbishop. And one of the plans had been that, one of the contingency plans had been that perhaps President Diem and his brother Nu could be shipped first to the Philippines and then to Rome and given safe haven with his brother through the Catholic Church. Nobody really believed that this was going to happen. I think Kennedy, who knew Diem and who had a more sensitive nature than he sometimes cared to acknowledge, I think he hoped against hope that Diem could be spared. But there were plenty of acknowledgments through the CIA that if the generals overthrew this man and his brother, that they were going to kill them. That they the real reason was Diem and Nu had a really active secret police, and they knew all the financial fiddles and all the other things that these generals had done. And if they had been left alive in exile, they would have been able to disgrace the ruling junta that had overthrown them. So we knew they were going to die. On the other hand, when it actually was announced, and it was first announced that they had committed suicide, even though their hands were tied behind their back, Kennedy did bolt from the meeting and took a moment to compose himself because he had met Diem, and he thought that in many ways he had been a decent leader and had tried hard for his country.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is A.J. Langeth. He covered the war in Vietnam for the New York Times. He's now professor of journalism in the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Southern California and is author of A New History of the War. It's titled Our Vietnam, The War 1954 to 1975, published by Simon & Schuster. The full-scale involvement in the war of the United States in the war came during the Johnson administration, and the event that really made that possible, that paved the way for that, was the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
Yes.
And I'd like to talk a little bit about that and that event and what you can say about the motivation of Lyndon Johnson here. It happened in 1964. North Vietnamese patrol boats fired on an American destroyer. Then President Johnson said that this was on August 2nd. Then he said there had been a second attack a couple of days later, which turned out not to be correct. But based on that, the Congress endorsed the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and that essentially gave the president the authority to go ahead and become militarily involved to the degree that we did. Can you talk a little bit about what happened and why you think Lyndon Johnson did what he did?
Oh, yes. It's a fascinating story to me. And in the final piece of the puzzle came when I was in Hanoi a couple of years ago. This is what happened. We thought, our policymakers believed, that policy out of Hanoi was as closely held as it is in Washington, that there was somehow a Pentagon equivalent in Asia. Well, there wasn't. And because of bad communication and because of the problems, different commanders would be given instructions and then considerable autonomy. So the chief in charge of Tonkin Gulf patrols fired on August 2nd, ordered his men to fire on some spy units that we were sending into that area. And Jap, the general from the north, was appalled. It was a folly. It was going to invite recrimination. He gave an immediate order, sent it down to this man, don't do this again. So when on October 4th there were reports by nervous sailors, U.S. sailors, that they were being menaced, Jap, for one, knew that it was impossible because they just weren't going to repeat that mistake. Johnson had a wonderful opportunity. He was running against Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater was a hawk and widely perceived as perhaps a dangerous man with the nuclear button. So Johnson had resisted earlier provocations in the South, some bombings of U.S. installations, because he wanted to show that he was not going to be rushed into precipitous action. But this gave him a wonderful opportunity. It was a clear-cut aggression at sea, the original attack. Still, he held back, and he didn't do anything. He didn't know what to do. But when there was this shadowy report of a second one, he dusted off a resolution that he had had Bill Bundy in the State Department draw up some months before, authorized, it was really open-ended. It was kind of a non-specific declaration of war, a blank check. He dusted that off, had it rewritten, and hustled it over to the Congress. Well, they were still feeling that the North was thumbing its nose at the United States, not only having had the first attack, but now was doing it again, despite our dire warnings. And it passed with the exception of two votes. Gruning of Alaska and Wayne Morris of Oregon were the only two people in the Senate who rose up and said, you know, this is madness. We're declaring war with this blank check, and it's not just war itself, but it's we're going to vote him all the money he needs. We just shouldn't be doing this. But Fulbright, who later became a leading critic of the war, rammed it through at Johnson's behest through the Congress, and it became the only real legal authorization for the war for the rest of the time we were there.
Another very important turning point came in January of 1968 with the Tet Offensive, and it was this very successful operation by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong that then, I think, persuaded a lot of people in this country that that there was no winning this war, and all that would happen was it would simply grind on for a long time without any decisive result. And another of the results, the things that happened just a couple of months later, Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not run again.
Yes.
Did the Vietnamese that you talked to, did they believe that this was going to be as important for them as it turned out to be?
Well, I think they hoped that it was going to be even more important.
Hmm.
We forget, maybe in many at the time we didn't know, that they had big, big hopes for this. Now, they were always operating under a policy that you fought and you tried to negotiate at the same time, but you never negotiated until you were at a position of strength. So this was what they really hoped. And this was a decision by this man, Le Duan, because by this time, and this is what I know we didn't understand, the CIA certainly didn't, that Ho had taken himself out of the scene. He told his Politburo, I'll be your flag, I'll be your icon, but you make the decisions from here on in. And Jap had been against the Tet Offensive. He thought it was premature because it wasn't supposed to be just the offensive, which was a great success in that they stood up and took all of these province capitals, if only for an hour or two, all over the country at a time when Westmoreland had just said there was light at the end of the tunnel. And all of a sudden they were popping up with inside the embassy compound walls in Saigon. So it was a great success on that level, but it was also supposed to be not only that, it was supposed to be a great uprising in which the people themselves would come forward and acknowledge that they were on the side of the communists, that the war was over, that they would no longer be vassals of the puppet, American puppets. And instead of that, the people just cowered in their houses and didn't want any part of it. So the general uprising that they hoped would be the final propaganda coup did not happen. So it was a mixed bag. But in terms of its effect on the American public, excuse me, there was no question that to see this demonstration of support spread out through all of South Vietnam on one day was devastating.
There is so much more that we could do if we had more time, and I'm sorry to say that we don't. I would certainly recommend to people that they look at the book. Maybe just as a final question I might ask, I'm sure that you spent a lot of time thinking about the war. You covered part of the war as a journalist, but I wonder whether, as a result of going back over the material, looking at things you hadn't seen before to produce this book, that you came away with an understanding of the war that you had not had before.
Yes, I think the main one was never believe it when we're told, well, policy might not make sense to you, but the people making it know more than we do. They've got more information. They simply did not. And I don't think it has to leave us cynical, but it can certainly leave us skeptical about confiding all decisions to our government. We've got to examine them one at a time. And if we had done that properly in 1961, 62, we could have averted the war.
Well, I want to say thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
I'm happy to have the chance.
Our guest, A.J. Langeth. He covered the war in Vietnam for the New York Times. He was the Saigon bureau chief there in 65. He's now professor of journalism at the Annenberg School for Communication at University of Southern California. And the book is Our Vietnam, The War, 1954 to 1975. It's published by Simon & Schuster.